Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Standard for Pleading Falsity Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 24, 2015, the Supreme Court decided Omnicare v. Laborers District Council Construction Industry Pension Fund. This case concerns Section 11 of the Securities Act of 1933, which authorizes suit by a purchaser of securities issued under a registration statement filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission if the registration statement contained an untrue statement of material fact or omitted to state a material fact required to be stated therein or necessary to make the statement therein not misleading. The question here is whether a Section 11 plaintiff may plead that a statement of opinion was untrue merely by alleging that the opinion itself was objectively wrong, as the Sixth Circuit concluded in this case, or whether the plaintiff also must allege that the statement was subjectively false, requiring allegations that the speaker's genuinely held opinion was different from the one expressed, as the Second, Third, and Ninth Circuits have held. By a vote of 9-0, the court vacated the judgment of the Sixth Circuit and remanded the case. In an opinion delivered by Justice Kagan, the court held that a statement of opinion does not constitute an untrue statement of fact for purposes of Section 11 simply because the stated opinion ultimately proves incorrect. Even so, the court allowed that an omission could make an expression of opinion misleading if a reasonable investor would find that the facts omitted could not be squared with a fair reading of the registration statement as a whole. The Sixth Circuit must reassess the plaintiff's claim on remand, applying the standard, the court explained. Justice Kagan's opinion was joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, Alito, and Sotomayor. Justice Scalia filed an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment. Justice Thomas also filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. To discuss the case, we have George Conway, who is a partner in the litigation department of Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Conway.
Hi, everyone. Omnicare is an important case that addresses the difference between how opinions and facts are treated under the federal securities laws. The case involved a provision called Section 11 of the Securities Act of 1933, and that's a very important liability provision. It's an express right of action created explicitly by Congress, and it addresses public offerings of securities. And when you have a public offering of securities, you're required to register the securities with the SEC so that you can legally sell them to the public. And to do that, you have to file what's called a registration statement, which contains all sorts of information about your business. What Section 11 does is it creates strict liability for false or misleading statements in a registration statement. And here's what Section 11 says. It reads, quote, in case any part of the registration statement, when such part became effective, contained an untrue statement of material fact or omitted to state a material fact required to be stated therein or necessary to make the statements therein not misleading, any person acquiring such security may sue. To boil that down, it means that you're on the hook if either, one, your registration statement contains an untrue statement of material fact, or two, if your registration statement omits a material fact that you needed to make something you said not misleading. And one question that has come up countless times over the years is, when someone expresses an opinion, can that be an untrue statement of material fact? And that's an issue that comes up under a lot of provisions that have similar language about false statements or untrue statements of fact. For example, when a CEO says, in my opinion, with our newly improved manufacturing process, our factory will be able to produce 10,000 widgets a day, and it turns out that they only crank out, say, 7,000. Is that a false statement? What if the guy actually believed he could crank out 10,000, but there are unforeseen problems? In a case called Virginia Bank Shares back in 1991, the Supreme Court seemed to address those issues. And Virginia Bank Shares was a terribly convoluted opinion by Justice Souter, and I urge you never to read it if you don't have to, and frankly, now no one will ever have to. But the bottom line is that the courts of appeals after Virginia Bankshares interpreted the Bankshares opinion to mean that for an opinion, a statement of opinion to be false, the person expressing the opinion had to disbelieve the opinion. And the idea is, when you're expressing an opinion, I believe X, you're not saying that X is true, you're just saying, I believe X is true. So the fact that's at issue, the only factual thing that's in your opinion is your belief, your state of mind. So the guy says, we'll crank out 10,000 widgets in my opinion. He's not saying you can take that to the bank. He's just saying, I believe we can crank out 10,000 widgets. And so it's false only if he's lying. And that was the law until the Sixth Circuit's decision in this case in Omnicare. Omnicare is a company that provides pharmacy services for residents of nursing homes, among other things it does. And it's got to comply with lots of complicated federal and state laws like Medicare and so on. And in a registration statement it filed, it expressed a bunch of opinions basically saying, we believe we're in compliance with applicable laws. Well, long story short, Omnicare got sued by investors under Section 11, and the investors claimed that Omnicare's statements about legal compliance were false, that they weren't. The investors claimed that Omnicare wasn't, in fact, in compliance with applicable laws. The district court threw the case out, but the Sixth Circuit reversed. The Sixth Circuit held that even though the statements about legal compliance were opinions, the plaintiffs didn't have to show, like all the other courts held, that Omnicare didn't believe what it said. The Sixth Circuit held that all the plaintiffs had to show was that the statements were objectively false, in that Omnicare wasn't complying with the federal and state laws that it was referring to. And it didn't matter that Omnicare believed what it was saying. And that created a conflict with the other circuits, and so the Supreme Court granted cert. And late last month, on March 24, the Supreme Court vacated and remanded the Sixth Circuit's opinion. Justice Kagan wrote the opinion for herself and six other justices, and Justices Scalia and Thomas concurred in the judgment. Justice Kagan's opinion for the court rejected the Sixth Circuit's view of what's false, what's untrue, what's an untrue statement of material fact under Section 11. And essentially, her opinion for the court bought into what the majority of courts and what Omnicare was arguing about falsity. Expressions of opinion, the court held, explicitly affirm one fact, that the speaker holds the stated belief. As a result, the court held, and I'm quoting here, a sincere statement of pure opinion is not an untrue statement of material fact, regardless of whether an investor can ultimately prove the belief wrong. So, in other words, if the speaker believed the opinion, it's not false. Now, Omnicare's statements about legal compliance were, in fact, pure statements of opinion, and because there wasn't any dispute that Omnicare's opinion was honest, honestly held, truly believed, sincerely believed, the court held that those statements were not untrue statements of material fact under Section 11. Now, if Omnicare had had its way, that would have been the end of the case. But the court went on to address an issue that really hadn't been addressed in the lower courts and, frankly, not much in the prior case law. And that's the other phrase that I mentioned in Section 11. Remember, I said that Section 11 prohibits untrue statements of material fact, but it's also got that second phrase right afterwards about omitting a material fact that's needed to make something in the registration statement not misleading. And so what the court held as to this second phrase was that even if a defendant expresses an opinion that's sincerely believed and thus isn't an untrue statement of material fact because it's sincerely believed, that doesn't mean that the defendant gets off scot-free. Could be that the opinion is misleading under this second phrase because of something that the company or the defendant knows but hasn't told investors. And the court gave an example about a TV company CEO. Suppose the CEO of this TV manufacturer says her company's TVs have the best resolution on the market, and she really believes that. But suppose she didn't bother to look at the competition's specifications. And the opinion, her opinion may be misleading because investors would assume that if she's making this statement about what she thinks is the best on the market, one would assume she looked at the specs for the other companies. So that would be a material omitted fact that investors would want to know, and not telling investors that she didn't really do her homework, but giving them her opinion would be misleading. And the court also gave another example based on the kind of statement made by Omnicare. Suppose a company said, we're in compliance in the law, just like Omnicare did, but it didn't consult lawyers. It just sort of, it was just expressed a belief, the CEO expresses a belief without asking a lawyer what the law requires. That might be misleading too. In other words, if you express the opinion, you also got to disclose the fact that you didn't talk to any lawyers and you didn't do any spade work. Now, the reason why the court held that omitted facts can render an opinion misleading was that investors expect an opinion fairly aligns with information in the issuer's possession. Accordingly, the court said, and I'm quoting here, if a registration statement omits material facts that conflict with what a reasonable investor would take from the opinion, then Section 11's omissions clause creates liability. And the court remanded the case back to the Sixth Circuit and the district court for consideration of the omission claim. Now, a lot of defense lawyers were fearful that the court might focus on this omission piece of Section 11, and in light of what the Solicitor General had argued, which was that piece of Section 11 requires defendants to make statements that are only statements that are reasonable. But the court didn't go the whole way with what the Solicitor General was arguing. The court went out of its way, to the contrary, to stress that it wasn't declaring some sort of litigation open season on opinions. The court emphasized that it actually is going to be fairly difficult for plaintiffs to bring opinion-based omission claims that survive dismissal. The court said that not every fact cutting the other way had to be disclosed because reasonable investors don't expect that every fact known to an issuer supports an opinion statement. And the court emphasized that context matters a lot in weighing whether or not some fact is required to be, some admitted fact is required to be disclosed in light of an opinion. The court explained that investors take into account an opinion's surrounding text and all the hedges, disclaimers, and conflicting information that issuers put in a registration statement, as well as the customs and practices of the relevant industry. And so the court told district courts, in effect, that Section 11 doesn't operate in a vacuum and that it creates liability only for the omission of material facts, and again, I'm quoting here, that cannot be squared with a fair reading of an opinion in the broader frame of its full context. So, and I'm paraphrasing here, material omissions can't be pleaded by means of conclusory assertions or, and the court, this is a quote, threadbare recitals, that's a close quote. Instead, a complaint must identify particular and material facts going to the basis of the issuer's opinion, facts whose omission makes the opinion statement at issue misleading in context. So what the court did was it left open the possibility of liability for sincerely held opinions, but it carefully limited that possibility. And the court also, interestingly, gave advice to issuers on how they can convey opinions that don't mislead. The court said, quote, to avoid exposure for omissions under Section 11, an issuer need only divulge an opinion's basis or else make clear the real tentativeness of its belief. So in the end, I think that while Omnicare changed the theoretical framework for analyzing Section 11 claims based on opinions and moved the needle a bit in favor of plaintiffs, the court didn't really move the needle that much. And the reason is all that language in the opinion about how tough it's going to be for plaintiffs to plead that an opinion is misleading. At the end of the day, and I guess time will tell if I'm right, to plead opinions that are misleading under Omnicare, plaintiffs are going to have to come up with the same sort of facts that they had to come up with before Omnicare to show when they had to show that opinions were disbelieved and untrue because they were disbelieved. There is one nice effect, though, that Omnicare will have for securities lawyers like me, and it's that we will never have to read that awful opinion in Virginia Bank Shares again. Anyway, I hope this was helpful, and thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.